the flyer is part of Portland Art Focus. So it has all the academic galleries, the museums, the not-for-profits, and the Art Dealers Association. And the Art Dealers Association, PADA, under Lynn Terry, is the one who actually produces this and brings everybody together and reminds people of deadlines. And I mean, she's been amazing, and she's done it for since the beginning, the the flyer.
And this, so then when you first open up this magazine, these the first advertisements, like full page, those are PADA people, PADA galleries. But then as you progress, there are ads for galleries all over the town, no?
Correct.
That's ad. That's revenue ad for the flyer. That's what that is. But it's also selective. And then the map has everybody in it.
Yes, if you get to the very end here, and I've actually given this magazine out to a ton of people who are like, where should I go, right? I just give them this. So it's really a great resource. And, well, now, it seems to me, Bob, you told me that Seattle, for instance, didn't have one of these for a while, and they asked you, like, what was the roadmap for, to being able to produce this, right? I mean, this is kind of a responsibility and, it's, and an expenditure in its own right.
I can't recall whether Seattle actually put one out early on. William and I decided to put one out if we were going to initiate an event like this. And the first one that was printed was actually a big newsprint, a higher quality newsprint, black and white flyer that was on an 11 by 17 format when you opened it up. And it was an 8-page spread. And that publication came out in September or October of 1986. And slowly over time, that morphed into a color flyer that you see right now on a smaller format so that it was easier to carry around, easier to fit in a handbag or a pocket or a briefcase.
Right.
And then Seattle also began to produce a flyer, and then Seattle went to a larger format flyer early on, and I think theirs is still on an 8.5 by 11 format, not a 6 or a 7 by 9.
So, you know, one thing I'm thinking is that, you know, there's a lot of galleries that come and go. I mean, as we know, I mean, I think the town's very bottom heavy with like artist run spaces, which may be anywhere here from 2 to 5 years, whatever they are.
Which are valuable.
But they're very, of course, no, they're very valuable, yes. We can talk about that, but I ran a couple of them at least. No, they're very valuable. But, you know, I think to be as a part of this, there's a certain longevity and commitment that must be there. Can we speak to that?
Or? Yeah, I mean, the Art Dealers Association has bylaws that are that kind of govern who can participate and how the organization itself is run. It is an invitation. It, you know, people are invited to join at a certain point. So most of the members in the organization are very much engaged with the community, whether it be an artist-run, another artist-run space or a nonprofit space. Most of us are somehow involved or pay attention to what's going on in the community. And over time, as organizations maybe evolve from a scrappy artist-run space into a more professional space with adhering to certain professional practices, it may be in their interest and in our interest to invite them to join. So it is sort of a I think PADA is part of an ecosystem of the arts in the city, for sure.
You have to be you have to have bricks and mortar. You have to have a space. You have to represent artists. Is it 3 years in business?
Generally.
So how does one get there? I mean, that is something
you have to stay in business.
How does one, I mean, I think that is just something that I think should be addressed here, or advice or whatever, because I've seen so many come and go. And I know it's, I mean, like when I closed shop, I was fine doing it, but there are always a bunch of people that are very sad for you. I mean, I remember when I did my last little thing, which was just for the summer, I wrote, you know, when you tell people you're having a show, people are happy for you. When you tell people you're opening a gallery, people are ecstatic. So because you're giving, you know, and you're doing something. What was your key to being able to stay open? I mean, what?
Well, I mean, I think that
we're all looking at each other, by the way.
I know. There's
no one key, by the way.
I mean, I think, you know, the if you look at the Portland Art Guide, the flyer, and there's one, you know, section that's Portland Art Focus, which are non-for-profit and museums, and they generally run through funding from patrons and grants and things like that. And the other 11 members, the Portland Art Dealers Association, obviously survive and function by selling art. So we have, and from my perspective, we have two sets of customers, if you will. We have the artists who are our clients that we represent and promote and develop and market for their work and help get them get into museum shows and build their reputation and their market. And then we have collectors who come in and buy work. And it's in both cases, it's about building relationships with those two sets of, of customers, if you will, and doing what you can to kind of match them up and create a viable business out of that.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you've been in business, I think, longer than anybody here at this table. And what can you talk about your longevity and all your time in business?
Well, the art business is a hard business, regardless of which community you're in. You're selling work to a relatively narrow group of people that have a disposable income and a desire. So you have to understand that you're probably not going to be a supplier of ubiquitous product to 99 2/3% of the folks. So one of the more important things to realize about the art business is that it is a business, and you have to pay attention to what your costs and what your expenses are going to be, who your customer base is, whether you have a large enough customer base in that area that you want to describe and define that will allow you to pay all your bills. Mm-hmm. And it is tough to match all of those particular variables up and find a formula that continually produces the benefits and the assets that you want going forward. So
would you say, too, that the artists who can be the most successful are the ones who not only deliver the work, right, but understand all those things that you just mentioned? I mean, I know from my own personal experience, I had a long time to get out of the romance. I mean, not out of it completely, but a little bit out of the romance of art and into the business of art.
I don't think it's... Every case is different. And,
yes.
And the way each gallery stays in business is a little bit different. And their approach. And I think it's the same way. It's really, really helpful if the artist participates themselves and in the business of art. Mm-hmm. And the main thing is the artist has to produce enough volume of work. And you have to have multiple galleries to make it in a big way. I mean, you know, larger way.
Yes.
You can't just be in one gallery. I don't care which one gallery it is. There's
right.
So that requires enough work, and
is that a challenge getting artists to
it
make it?
Yeah, no, it can be. It depends on the artist.
Yeah,
but it is. It's really nice when an artist does understand the business side. It's not 100%
a given.
No,
right.
No, or they don't even have to 100%. I love it when they do.
Right,
but they don't have to.
Right. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Art Focus, and my name is Ava Lake. If you want more information about this radio show, you can go to kboo.fm/artfocus, and you can see links to my guests, and you can go back and listen to past interviews. I've been here a little over 5 years. I have with me today representatives from the Portland Art Dealers Association. I have with me Bob Cox, who has Ogden Gallery. I have with me Daniel Peabody, who is the director of the Elizabeth Leach Gallery. And I have with me Jane Beebe, who has PDX Contemporary Art. So one thing I wanted to ask you all is how you got into this, how you got into this game. Is something I had said before when we all got together was, you know, if you're a doctor, you go to school, you have something that's on the wall. The art business is, I mean, anybody could be an art dealer, I guess, right? What say you? to that statement?
I don't think there are any.
I don't think everybody's suited to it, no.
There are no restrictions to becoming an art dealer, and you don't have to be licensed. In other words, you don't have to go to school for 6 or 7 years. You don't have to pass a test. So in some ways, that also contributes to the fact that large quantities of businesses are short-lived. It's a much more experimental kind of business than what you get if you have a...
You're a dentist.
Entire institution built up to train people and license people and ensure that there are customers out there for those licensed people.
I think some people are definitely more suited for it than others. But I think, you know, Bob is right. There isn't sort of, you know, there isn't any requirement to sort of enter the field. But I think it definitely, there are certain traits that work out well for people who have them.
So, Daniel, how did you end up where you are? Like, what was your path to being the director of this big gallery now?
Well, my background, I did go to school for the arts. I studied art and art history. I have a BFA in fiber arts and textiles and an MFA in interdisciplinary art. So my background is actually as a maker. In my final year of graduate school, I was hired by the university to have a position running the academic gallery. And it was sort of, as from an art perspective now, it was sort of trial by fire. The shows were of students' work, and they changed every week.
So it was
pretty intense, but I realized that I really loved organizing exhibitions or working with artists to organize their exhibitions. And then I worked in design here in Portland for 2 years, and then I was hired at the gallery. It was sort of being in the right place at the right time, and I've been there 8 years, so it's been a good fit.
So can I ask you, are you still making, and if not, how did you reconcile it all in your head?
Well, as I said, the final year of my graduate program, I was still making, of course, but shifted towards more working on exhibitions, and I really enjoyed that. So it's been kind of a dual path. For a few years out of school, I did continue making work, and I occasionally, maybe a day a month or something, work on a project that is sort of studio related, but I have sort of shifted my focus to what I'm doing now.
All right. So now, Jane, you used to work at William Jameson. And how did you get to even be doing that? When did you know you wanted to have your own gallery when you started with somebody else?
No, I didn't. If William was still living, I'd probably happily still be working with him. But we were next door neighbors. We fixed up condemned houses and we became friends. And then the short version is I had started taking architecture classes when my youngest entered kindergarten. And I ran into William on 14th and Lovejoy.
Yeah.
And he said,
this in the 80s?
Continue. Yeah. And he said, are you going to continue the architecture? And I said, I need a swifter route to employment. Spencer quit his job today. And he said, I've always wanted to work at the gallery. Come work at the gallery. So then I thought about it.
Wow.
And I didn't think of myself. I didn't think I could ever sell in 1,000 years. I thought that I can't possibly take on a job that involves selling, because I didn't think I'd be able to do that.
Right. And so how were you able to, like, I mean, I know that I didn't think I'd probably could sell way back when, and then I've sold just about everything now.
You care about it.
Yeah, right?
You care about it. Yeah. Yeah, so, and, you know, I see it as it's making the process go on. It's giving artists a living so they can keep making art. And so it's very satisfying when you place the right piece with the right person. So the person goes home really happy that they have this in their life, enriching their life. And the artist is happy because they're making a living, and so it can be quite rewarding.
And how about you, Bob? I actually was at your very first gallery, the one when it was across from the library. So I think that might have been 79. And you had a partner, I remember. I mean, there was two of you, I think. And so how did you get to that?
I had been an architect. And that was my original training. And when I reached the age of 29 or 30, I decided to shift gears. So I went back to New York, ran into a number of people back there, and began to handle prints by fairly well-known people. I was the a priori Western distributor for works coming out of Petersburg Press and Pace Prints. And they had begun to work with artists who were at that time younger to approaching mid-career, like David Hockney, Frank Stella, Jasper Johns. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I started in the business. I didn't have any local artists to speak of. I didn't know any local artists to speak of. My other partner was also an ex-architect who wanted to shift gears. And so we opened up a gallery and handled prints for the first couple of years.
Let me just ask you, what was it about architecture? Was it just boring for you? Was it not enough? So it's, how did some people want to be so into that. Why did you want out of that?
I think that at the particular point in time, the economy wasn't the best for architects. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of projects that I was involved in as an architect where so many things change during the course of the project or so much of the budget gets cut that you say at the end of the day, you know, if I would have known that was going to happen when I started, I wouldn't have taken the job. And so once you have a number of those kinds of events, you start saying, well, do I want to live a life where when I get to the end, I say to myself, you know, if I would have known it was going to end up like that,
right,
wouldn't have taken it.
Uh-huh. Too much ongoing cutting in negotiation, right?
You know, it was also the time when the economy was in transition.
Uh-huh.
So it was a good time to try something else.
Right. So.
And that stuck.
It stuck, yeah. Yes. So you started out with prints by well-known artists. What made you decide to represent, the local living, on their way artists such as myself? What was, because that's such two different things going on there.
As time went on, prints became more popular. As prints became more popular, they became more expensive.
Ah.
As they became more expensive, the publishers started putting a greater monetary demand on the people that were handling them, mm-hmm. to the point where certain artists you could only get if you invested your own money in them. And so there was a crossover time there where it became very hard to finance the show that you have on the wall, the show that you had just taken down, and the show that you have coming up with internal cash, and finding enough prints to continue to exhibit that way. So at some point in time, you had to find
the middle,
a supply of work from somebody that didn't necessarily cost you money in order to get them on the wall.
Yes, that's right. It's
initially.
True. It's true because,
you begin to work with local artists who are making work where you can take them on consignment so that you don't have to have this massive outlay of capital funding multiple shows all in different sequences of production before you actually see any sales out of it.
I love hearing the hardcore business person.
Bob is wonderful at giving that.
I need him as a partner.
I'm going to speak a little bit in terms of sort of the history of the gallery that I'm involved with, Elizabeth Leach Gallery. And Elizabeth came to Portland in the early 80s and didn't feel like there was much of a gallery, there was much of an art scene at that time from her perspective. And she decided she was going to bring art from Los Angeles, which is mm-hmm. where she had gone to school. And so when she first started the gallery, that was her model. But as soon as she opened a gallery and people started coming in, she realized there was, in fact, a huge community of art and artists here. Mm-hmm. And so she shifted her model and it started being the mission of the gallery still now is to put regional and local art in a national context. So we might show an artist of stature, the same as what sort of Bob was showing early on. Mm-hmm. Recently, you've done a Richard Serra show. Anne Hamilton show, uh-huh. or, et cetera. And then we put those artists and pair them with
local artists
or regional artists to kind of really show the wealth of creativity that exists here in this community.
Well, that's one thing I did want to address is how Portland has changed or grown, and also this idea of, I know more than one person has told me that Portland collectors, don't have a hard time collecting somebody from out of town. They like knowing the artist, this kind of thing. Has that changed, being able to mix it up? You all show artists that don't live in Portland. How about that?
Yeah. I think we don't have that much more time that That still is true, but the whole art world in the way of being in business for galleries
is changed.
Like everything else in life, is changing dramatically. And in SOPATA, the Portland Art Association, and the individual galleries have to find ways, as do museums, of being relevant going future, creating. We don't sit and wait for collectors to come to us. We have to go out there and, in some cases, almost create, you know, collectors. If people are, you know, open the doors to people, bring them in.
And have artist talks and things like that, and events, and work with the museum. And
they're all yeah, a lot of different efforts one has to make. And going forward, and with the internet and with art fairs, it is really changing the way business is. And it's not so much about space as much as events right now. Mm-hmm. But I think that Portland does have, and I think San Francisco is that way, they kind of like their own or the big blue chip names.
Yeah.
It, what's hard is to bring in an artist that has a higher price point from out of town that may be known very well outside of Portland, but not Portland, but they're expensive to Portland standards.
I get it.
I would also say that I think I think that in terms of what I would consider local, I would say more regional. Uh-huh. I think that as Portland has gotten larger and more connected, it's become more of a regional market rather than a specific local market. So whether it's an artist from Seattle or Portland or Eugene or somewhere else, you know, in the Northwest, I think there's definitely an interest in that, or in really well-established artists.
Well, I know there is an interest from the outside, of, you know, in Portland, of course. You know, I remember someone saying, oh, you know,
people
we just love
Portland.
Love the artists from Portland, Oregon. Yeah. And, you know, and I said, well, who do you love? You know, and then you, Ava, or whatever. It's like, I think there's a catch-up going on. You know, it's cool to say, you know, that they like what's going on here, but they don't always know what that is. So that's where you guys come in.
You know, we were asking why PATA exists. Huh. One of the things is that we can, as a group, do things we can't do as individuals. And one of the things we should say here today is we developed the Visual Art Award, the Portland Art Association for Visual Arts. Mm-hmm. And our first recipient was Julie Bernard.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Before we ended, I wanted to.
Yes, yes. How many times have you given that award? Christine Darcy just got it, right?
Yes. And it's a Christine's the fourth one. Joan Shipley.
Uh-huh.
And Laura Rousseau.
Yes.
And now Chris Darcy.
Nice, nice. Well, I'm going to wrap this up, you guys. Thanks so much for being my guests.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, we've had a discussion about the Portland Art Dealers Association, and I don't think I ever mentioned their website. So is it PATA?
Portland Art Dealers Association.
It's PATAOregon.org.
PATAOregon.org, right. Yes, that's the website. And they've got a blog. They've got all kinds of information about their artists and links to all the different galleries' websites, plus museums and other groups that are affiliated with the organization. I've had with me today Bob Cox of Ogden Gallery, Daniel Peabody of the Elizabeth Leach Gallery, and Jane Beebe of PDX Contemporary Art. My name is Ava Lake. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. Joseph Galvan will be here next week, so I'll be back in a couple of weeks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.fm under Community Events.
You're listening to news headlines at noon for Tuesday, March 25th on KBOO. Today in English and Spanish. In response to Russia's annexation of Crimea and Sevastopol, the group of eight industrialized democracies suspended Russia from the organization. Pro-Russia forces have occupied Crimea since February, when the pro-Russia president of Ukraine was removed from office. Last week, voters in Crimea and Sevastopol decided to secede from Ukraine, and Russian President Vladimir Putin announced Russia's annexation of the area. These events have been called a threat to Ukraine's self-determination by President Obama and European leaders. The G8 were set to gather in Sochi, Russia, this summer. The remaining seven announced a boycott of that assembly. The group is made up of Japan, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, the United Kingdom, and the United States now. Pro-Russian troops are reported to be increasing near Ukraine. And in response to the ouster, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said that Russia doesn't cling to the format of the G8. The U.S. Department of Energy has conditionally approved a liquefied natural gas terminal near Coos Bay. The project, known as Jordan Cove, now has Department of Energy approval to export liquefied natural gas to countries with which the United States does not have free trade agreements. Jordan Cove has had approval to export to free trade agreement countries since December of 2011. This approval occurred after a two-year process. Next, Jordan Cove needs a construction permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That process involves the completion of an environmental impact statement. A draft EIS is expected to be issued in April or May.
And now, Noticias en Español with Tania Gómez Daza. 14 muertos y 176 desaparecidos fueron reportados luego de un deslave ocurrido el pasado sábado en la localidad de Loso, en Washington. Equipos voluntarios y de rescate trabajan entre el fango y el lodo. Se prevén nuevas lluvias que podrían provocar más desprendimientos. Se anuncia que el avión Malasio, que fuera reportado como desaparecido en días pasados, se estrelló en algún lugar remoto y cayó en el Océano Índico. Asimismo, se dio a conocer que no hay pista alguna de las 239 personas que viajaban a bordo del vuelo MH370 de Malaysian Airlines. Un guardia nacional y una mujer embarazada murieron en Venezuela en los últimos dos días. Con estas dos muertes, la cifra de decesos sube a 36 desde que iniciara las protestas antigubernamentales hace un mes y medio. El Tribunal Supremo Electoral de El Salvador entregará esta noche las credenciales oficiales del presidente electo Salvador Sánchez Serén luego de que se rechazara el recurso interpuesto por el partido de derecha.
You've been listening to news headlines at noon on KBOO. This is Kelly Sunrose. For more local, national, and global news produced right here in our Portland studio, tune in weekdays at 5 p.m.
A la hora que me llamen voy, 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 siempre que me llamen.
yo voy a